This is Fresh Air. I'm not sure who Americans consider the most trusted man in America today, but for many years that description was linked to the name Walter Cronkite. Cronkite was the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News for 19 years. He retired in 1981 and was replaced by Dan Rather. But he never really left television. There's a new edition of his documentary series, The Cronkite Report, which will be shown next Monday on the Discovery Channel. It's called The Faltering Dream, and it examines the state of integration 30 years after Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. We thought this would be a good time to catch up with Cronkite and get him to tell us some behind-the-scenes stories from his years in television. He told me about the first time he anchored the news on April 16, 1962.
I remember my dear friend Andy Rooney, who I've known since World War II when we were in England and Europe together as correspondents. I remember his coming into the studio immediately after that 15-minute broadcast, and he said to me in his typical straightforward, no-holds-barred way, "What are you trying to sell me? you're punching too hard, Cronkite. You're punching. Don't sell me anything. Just tell me the news." And that was the first words I heard after I finished the first broadcast. And I appreciated it. And he was right, absolutely right.
How did you start saying at the end of your broadcast, "And that's the way it is"?
Well, that was a very contrived sign-off, obviously. And I'm a little embarrassed about it today. Dick Salant, the sainted late Richard Salant, who was president of CBS News when we went to the half hour, hated it and tried to talk me out of it. But being the stubborn Dutchman I am, I clung to it, and it became so much a signature so quickly that I was not inclined to give it up. But what happened was, when we went from a half hour to a half hour, I thought we'd have plenty of time. Fool that I was, naive as I was, I thought that doubling our time would give me time to end the piece with the kind of stories I always liked when I worked for the United Press and Scripps Howard. I liked the irony of fate stories, the little one-paragraph stories or two-paragraph stories that you put under an italicized head somewhere in the front page. And they were the little human interest touches. And if I use that kind of story, knowing that sign-off lines were terribly popular in broadcasting and always have worked for people, I thought maybe I could use one if I could find one that I could say as a tagline to either a humorous or a pathetic story. And you can say, "And that's the way it is," almost anyway. "And that's the way it is," you know, an ironic touch, or a satirical touch, or doubting touch, or "And that's the way it is," a sad touch, and a regretful touch. And so that's why I devised the line, and it certainly has stuck.
You say you're embarrassed about it now. Why are you embarrassed?
Because I think Dick Salant was right. We didn't get to use those irony of fate stories. Almost from the beginning of the evening news, there was so much news to cover in the half hour allotted to us, less than that, less subtracting commercials and lead-ins and lead-outs and so forth. There was so much to cover, we never got those irony of fate stories in. As a result, we were loading the broadcast with important news, and I was ending up saying, "And that's the way it is." An arrogant line, in a sense.
Right, that's how some people saw it, that you were saying, "I've told you what the news is, and that's all there is."
Well, not only that's all there is, but it's all correct.
Yeah, right.
And as Dick pointed out, we're not telling them all that is, and we make mistakes.
You were the anchor and managing editor of the evening news. When you became the anchor and managing editor, what were some of the changes you made or tried to make?
Well, I think the most important change was that I insisted on doing the broadcast from the desk where I worked, so there would not be a delay in getting from the newsroom to the broadcast location, the studio. And also, I would be in control throughout the half hour of the broadcast. The the reason for that was that I really was the managing editor, and I did not want to put copy on the air that somebody had prepared and handed to me. I wanted to see it off the wires. I wanted to make my own judgment on it before going on the air with it, and that was possible if we were in the newsroom operating. They could hand me the press service copy, teletypes bringing the press service copy could be practically at my elbow, and I could have writers and researchers sitting around the rim of the anchor desk, just as they would on a newspaper, I played it that way.
Well, speaking for myself, if I did a broadcast from my office, instead of hearing what I was talking about, listeners or viewers would just be saying, what a mess. You must have been under a lot of pressure to keep a pretty neat desk if you were broadcasting from it.
Not really. We swept the desk clean about 1/2 minute before going on the air. My motto was, our deadline is when we leave the air. We changed the broadcast right through to the time I signed off. It very seldom ended up precisely as we had planned it in advance. It drove producers and directors and technicians crazy, but that's the way I believed it should be done. There was no reason we had to close out the broadcast before we went on the air. If you've got capable people who can handle it on the microphone, on the cameras, and in the control room, there's no reason why you can't update that broadcast to the very last second.
My guest is Walter Cronkite, and there's a new edition of the Cronkite Report that will be shown next Monday on the Discovery Channel. It's called The Faltering Dream. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Walter Cronkite. Now, in your early days in radio, one of the things you did was the kind of baseball broadcast that Ronald Reagan did early in his career, play-by-play through telegraph announcements. So you'd get the telegraph announcements of what was happening, and you'd do your play-by-play based on that. It's hard for me to imagine you getting really worked up on the radio about a home run. I've never heard you in that kind of excited state that we expect from sportscasters.
You've missed a great deal of the best of my broadcasting. Johnson's up at the plate now, and he's got a pretty good record against this pitcher, but we can't expect a lot today. He hadn't been doing very well lately. But here's the first pitch, and it's a strike. It's a strike against Johnson. He took that one looking at it. He's up there again now, and there's another pitch. Oh, and there's a hit. It's a hit. It's on the way out. It looked like it's a home run for Johnson. He's on the way. He's driving Ed Boggs in ahead of him, and it's a 2-run lead for the Yankees. You don't like that, huh?
That's fine. That's fine. It seems out of character. Very interesting. Well, I can't, you know, for somebody who's been such the journalist, what was it like to reconstruct ball games as if you were there when you really weren't?
It was phony. No, it wasn't really phony so much. The facts were all correct. The excitement was was correct, too, in a way. I was excited about how the game went. I think there was a little bit of showmanship in it, quite clearly, which I wouldn't have permitted in news broadcasting. But it's a different, excuse the expression, ball game.
Right. Let's talk about what I think for many Americans it was one of your most memorable moments as a broadcaster, and I mean, it was a shocking moment in broadcasting. I'm sure you know what I'm getting at. It was the day Kennedy was shot, and you made the announcement on CBS that he was shot, and then made the announcement that he was dead. How did you end up being the one to go on the air?
Well, I was the one who carried most of the burden of our spontaneous or extemporaneous news coverage in those days. I was the anchor man of the evening news and usually the broadcaster of conventions, elections, things of that kind. So it would not have been unnatural for me to do it. But actually, the fact was that I was in the newsroom preparing the evening news broadcast. We'd I was there right when the wires, the United Press had the beat. Merriman Smith, the White House correspondent for United Press, got the first break, and the bulletin bells rang on the machine. We all gathered around, and there was the news that shots rang out, and today is President Kennedy's motorcade toward the streets of Dallas. Bing, 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 another bulletin. The motorcade is broken up, and it appears that it's on the way to a hospital. President Kennedy may have been hit. And with that, well, we immediately ordered up the air and went on the air. We couldn't get the camera warm immediately. In those days, we didn't keep one warm for those purposes, although after this experience, we did. But they started warming up a camera and moving it into place in the newsroom. Meanwhile, I went into an announce booth and went on the air as a voiceover over a bulletin slide over a soap opera that was on at the time.
When you went on to say that Kennedy was dead, your eyes teared. And that's something that we've seen replayed so many times on, you know, every anniversary of the death. And I mean, it's become one of these historic moments of broadcasting. Were you concerned about getting emotional on the air? Did you try to be as emotionless and stoic as possible? And were you concerned when you realized that your eye was tearing?
Well, I wasn't concerned about my eye tearing. I was concerned about my voice choking and not being able to speak. And that concerned me quite a lot. The tearing didn't matter. I didn't really think about it, except the concern that I wouldn't be able to get the words out.
How close did you come to not being able to get them out?
Pretty close, I think. I remember a moment of real terror that I was going to choke up and fall apart, as it were.
Did you know Kennedy?
Oh, yes. Yes, I knew him from the time he was a senator, and I knew him fairly well, not intimately, but I knew him as one of the many news sources in Washington.
Mm-hmm. As a journalist and broadcaster, did you think it was acceptable to let some emotion show?
Oh, yes, I think it was then, and I think it is now. I don't think if one happens to be an emotional type and has a little problem with that, perhaps, that there should necessarily try to suppress it. It could be overdone. If one were so emotional that every story broke him up, that would be unacceptable, obviously. But to have it happen once or twice in a broadcasting career is not that exceptional.
I realize that you are not fully retired. You're still doing documentaries and many other things as well. But you are retired from the evening news. What has surprised you about your retirement?
That CBS did not make any further use of me. My contract called for me to be doing special events broadcasting and a series of broadcasts similar to one I'd had on when I stepped down from the evening news called Walter Cronkite's Universe, a 13-week summer replacement series. And because there's a change of command at CBS they had their own reasons why they did not use me at all. And I was very much surprised about that.
And angry?
Yes, I think so.
So what are your impressions now of the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather and Connie Chung?
I think they're doing a fine job. Now, what do you expect me to say? No, I really do. I think that all three of the networks are doing well. I'm disappointed at the trend of all three networks to featureize the news. I without telling you which network I think does this most often, I try to stick with that at network, which I think is covering the news and not going to give me a long prepared feature story.
And you won't say which one that is?
No.
All right. The word most often used to describe you, I think, has been avuncular. And in fact, your nickname to a lot of people was Uncle Walter. So what did you think of the avuncular title and the uncle title?
In retrospect, I love it because the subsequent appellation was fatherly Walter Cronkite, and then it got to be grandfatherly Walter Cronkite. So I'll go back to avuncular any day.
And how'd you feel about it at the time?
Oh, I thought it was kind of affectionate. I didn't care. I mean, it was rather nice.
Walter Cronkite. The next edition of the Cronkite Report will be shown Monday evening on the Discovery Channel. This is Fresh Air.